5202.
Professor Weintraub's Managed Care Class, 112608, Podcast 9, Room 205.
Yeah, I know. So it's getting me to law school.
Okay, we're recording. So, be available to everyone. Last two lectures will be available to everyone. Extra handouts. I brought them with me if you want to fill in, and we can always make some more. So, this is our last lecture, and it's been a nice time to have a managed care class. There's so much discussion about healthcare. We've had a lot of fodder to deal with. So, the first thing that I'm going to do today is go over, do the review of last week's lecture, and then we'll go over the exam. That I've given you the same exam that I handed out before. Today, in this handout today, there are two things in the handout today. One is the notes from last week, you know, the, we call that the expanded syllabus. The notes that I hand out each week is really an expanded syllabus. And the second is a copy of last year's exam, but it's the same thing that I gave you a few weeks ago to help you decide whether you want to write a paper or take the exam or to give you some preview. But I just gave it again today because my experience is that it's hard to discuss it if you left that other copy home. So, you know, I just give you the, an extra copy, but I don't want you to be confused thinking that I've given you more than one exam. That being said, I intend to email everybody two more exams, the one from 06 and the one from 05, as an indication of the variation in the exams and the similarity in the exams and how, you know, by extrapolating, you can figure out what questions seem to come up most of the time. So, so in lecture 13, we had a review of the debate previously, and we answered the question: does managed law have the potential to significantly affect the practice of law in the way that managed care has affected the practice of medicine? And our conclusion was: do you have to worry? No. No, you don't have to worry for a number of reasons. And, you know, we reviewed Potvin versus Metropolitan Life. Should a managed care company be allowed to terminate a doctor's contract without cause? Nope. Now, don't be afraid. It's the last day, you know. You may never see me again. Well, hope that's not true. But no, and it was some like a public policy reasons that the judges said that it was that such a contract cannot be terminated without cause. It was a notion that the insurance companies had become too powerful in that regard, and that the doctor's practice could have been decimated if, as what happened in that case. Balin versus Sarah Bush Lincoln Healthcare Center. This is a healthcare center that was actually licensed as a hospital. And the claim was that the restrictive covenant for physicians after terminating employment, a 50-mile radius restricted zone, could not be enforced because this hospital or healthcare center was not entitled to practice medicine. All they could do would be to hire physicians who then would practice medicine. And that's what's known as the restriction against the corporate practice of medicine. We want people to render the care, not corporations. But hospitals are an exception. The hospital's charter and the hospital law of the states allow the hospital to be operated as a corporation. But that is the exception. And the case says that this was a healthcare center, which was a corporation, but it's licensed as a hospital. It's part of a hospital setting. What are vertically integrated healthcare organizations? Horizontally integrated healthcare organization is Ophthalmic Consultants of Long Island, a vertical or horizontally integrated my old firm, is that a vertically or horizontally oriented practice?
Horizontally,
one specialty. How about Partners Healthcare in Massachusetts? Everything. All specialties, all you could make the point that it's not only vertically oriented, but individual groups are horizontally oriented as well, but you wouldn't term that a vertically oriented. Why did these organizations develop in response to managed care? Two reasons. They could bargain better as partners in Massachusetts, you know, partners as part of the Harvard Brigham complex. As they have shown that if you get big enough, in the article we gave you last week, if you get big enough, managed care starts saying that they're unfair. It's kind of, you know, that they were successful in becoming large enough so that they could bargain successfully with managed care organizations, and the effect was in Massachusetts that it became noticeable that they were getting better fees than non-affiliated hospitals and physicians. So much so that that was really the last article I gave you, was policymakers are looking into that fact. But you could argue that's why they did it, and they are one of the few that got big enough to be successful, because we did mention that if you get big but not big enough, you can be vulnerable because you have some fixed costs that you must meet, and so maybe the managed care companies know that and say, well, they have all these fixed costs, so they have to give us a better deal because there'd be a lot of people going out of business if they, a lot of doctors affected. So you have to be not just big, but very big to bargain with managed care. The other reason that they evolved was because groups were better able to accept risk. When there were, when capitated contracts were more frequent than they are now, only large organizations could accept the risk, saying that we'll see a patient for $1 a month, whether they're sick or not. They're really insuring the insurance company, but you have to be big to do that. How has Partners Healthcare Massachusetts interfaced with managed care organizations? They have done it, they've interfaced with them very successfully because of their size. Fraud and abuse. I gave you the handout. You sure can bring that handout with you to the exam. So which says that there are really two kinds of fraud and abuse claims. One is false claims, which can be if a claim was for service not actually performed, but it could be for failure to document. Just, if you don't write it down, it's like you never did it. Overcharging for services delivered, charging Medicare, Medicaid more than charged for other patients, except managed care patients, upcoding, charging for a higher level of service than what was delivered, failure to collect coinsurance and deductibles. That's counterintuitive. Right? It's counterintuitive. A doctor, being a nice guy, a nice lady, says, forget it, they gave me enough. Fraud and abuse, because you said you billed for 100%, but you really only, in effect, billed for 80%. So you lied. You billed for more than you were going to get from this transaction. And besides, there's a societal reason why deductibles and coinsurances have been interposed, so that the patient has some interest in being charges. Double billing, you know, receiving payment from Medicare and from another source as well, which is can be a problem with if you set up a concierge care, say Medicare patient, you know, pay me $1,000 up front and then I'll take care of you and we'll bill Medicare for what we can. You have to do that with a contract, a written contract with a concierge patient to do that. Could advise someone to do that. And in that contract, you can mention many things, including a pair of slippers in a cubby in the office just for you, special silk examining gowns, a special waiting room with soft lights and heat, you know, things like that. But what can't you mention in that contract to avoid any claim of fraud and abuse? What can't you mention? What can't you include in that contract?
Covered services.
Exactly. Anything that Medicare would consider covered. You know, we don't pay for silk gowns. You know? We don't pay for access to your cell phone. But in one case, we do pay for you to actually communicate with other doctors when you send a patient for a consultation. You don't have to go, but you must review the reports of the consultants. So there should be nothing important in that contract. No, this $2,000 has to be structured so it's for stuff that's not medically necessary, not important. Newsletter, $2,000 newsletter. But you know, it's a construction. It's a construction that allows a different type of medical practice. So, service is not medically necessary. Or for false diagnosis, which sometimes is really overlapping. And worthless service, as you'll see in these notes. And anti-kickback. Referral fees are kickbacks. Not allowed in medicine. They're thought to increase the price of the care. It's a little counterintuitive for attorneys because in the practice of law, such a structure is allowed. But in medicine, it's a no-no. Even if the physician, referring physician, stays involved in the care, the physician can bill the patient separately but cannot get a kickback from the facility or person. That other doctor who is treating the patient. You want to stay involved in the care? Bill the patient separately. Don't get paid by the other doctor. So whereas in law, if you refer someone to another attorney, and you do get a referral fee, you really are expected to stay involved in the case. I don't know what you think of whether that's the practice or not, but most guidelines say that the referring attorney should stay involved in the case, should know what's going on in the case. The only difference is that attorney can accept the payment directly from the receiving attorney. In medicine, you can't do that. And there are many schemes that have been devised to sort of hide kickbacks. Doc, if you send me all your patients who need such and such surgery, you can practice in my building here for nothing. That's a kickback. Any services that go back and forth between doctors, referring doctors, and those treating the patient after referral. Any arrangements have to be at market value, at arm's length. There are some exceptions, which is part of the Medicare, Medicaid, of course, but it's illegal to offer a kickback, to give a kickback. It's illegal to receive a kickback. Both parties are liable. So let's go to the note sheet. Starts with Mike V. Strauss. When my poor quality of a medical service give rise to a judgment for fraud and abuse, really is on the sheet. Quality so poor as to render the service totally useless. Remember, the claim was that this radiology equipment was so inferior, it just wasn't good medical practice. The court said, we're not getting involved in what's good medical practice or not. You show me that it was a sham, it was worthless, that no one could read anything from that x-ray, and that we would have said that was fraud and abuse. But don't ask us to adjudicate what is good or bad medical practice. We're not going to get into that. We'll be here for hundreds and hundreds of years doing it. So, that's sort of counterintuitive also, that as it says in this, when my poor quality of a medical service gives rise to a judgment for fraud and abuse. I mean, I think intuitively you'd say, if it's poor quality, then that's fraud. It could even be abuse, but not legally. It has to be totally worthless service. What's a key Tom claim? In Mike C. Strauss, there was a key Tom relator. The person who was fired, the radiologist who was fired, ratted on the ratted on the previous employer. This is terrible medicine that's being practiced. What is a key Tom claim? If there's anything you should take away from today, it's the notion that there's a key Tom claim that could come and bite you while you're just sitting in your office doing nothing. You got to knock on the door, and a client comes in and says, "You know what? What should I do? I work for a doctor, and I was the billing agent, still am the billing agent, and this doctor tells me that every time someone comes in for a pimple, we bill it as a cosmetic procedure removal of tumor. And we do a lot of those, maybe two or three a day, dermatology practice. What should I do?" Okay? Now, I can tell you, if you don't do the right thing, you're in big trouble. Okay? So what should you do? Anybody? Well, let's see. One of the things you could do is to say, have you talked to your employer about this and told him you didn't think it was right? Should you do that? I don't think so. How about, let's go to Medicare. Let's report it to Medicare. Or let's report it to the state. Is that good? No, that's not good either. Because a key Tom relator gets a big bunch of money from the action. Key Tom means he who sues in the place of the government. But in order to get that money, you have to sue. So on this Friday afternoon, you have to say, we'll start an action, a key time action in court, in the name of the government, and we'll, after we file this action, we'll ask if the government wants to join us. That's how we'll do it. In the meantime, don't say anything to anybody. So what happened is, so there's a case, right? And let's say that in this case, in Mike's, that there was a better claim. And there were 100 instances of false claims. Well, that could run into millions of dollars in fines and repayments. And the key time relator can get up to 40% of that. So, although this scenario has never happened, it's possible that it would. That you tell this client, you know what? We're going to tell the government. We're going to tell the health department of the state about this. Or Medicare. We'll go to the inspector general with this. And then client finds out that, gee, after we gave up this information, we pretty much, once the government started the action, we couldn't do it anymore. We got precluded from that. We no longer had special information. Or I say, well, go tell your employer. The employer fired you. You wouldn't be in a position to, as good a position, to get the information that you would need. Court. Case. And the client goes to someone else, or the brother-in-law is a healthcare attorney, and said, well, gee, you could have started a key time action. So I think it's not unreasonable to think that you could be liable for the $1 million for failure to start a timely action. And you probably should do it quickly, because who knows, maybe the government does. Maybe Medicare has sent something, is going to investigate that. You have to do it before the government does. So once the government starts an action, you can't do it anymore. So I think that's some special knowledge that you can take with you for the rest of your career, is that in not only Medicare or Medicaid, but any government contracting, if there's fraud and abuse, if there are false claims made, if someone comes to you from Boeing and says, you know, for those fighter planes we're building, they're using a tissue paper for one of the wings. When government money is involved, think Key Tom right away, and it could work well. Key Tom actions are very powerful. And lucrative not only for the key time relator, which is the person who is going to sue, but for any attorney that representing the key time relator as well. Okay, how should a key time claim be initiated? Let's say, my attorney be liable for not properly filing a key time claim for a client? You bet. Under what circumstances might an attorney be charged with fraud and abuse for advice given regarding the practice of medicine? We discussed this last week. You know, this is not so much on, this is not on the topic of managed care, but it is on the topic of the doctor-patient relationship. The doctor is billing for removal of tumor for every little pimple and comes to you and says, you know, I've been doing this. Think it's okay?
And you say,
have they said anything?
No,
they pay the claims. Say, well,
is a pimple a tumor?
Any way you could say that? Is that true?
Doctors, any little mass, like a pimple, you could refer to it as a tumor. It
might meet the definition in the medical dictionary is.
Tumor.
Cysts are tumors?
This isn't.
These are just little cysts.
And you think back to law school and say, well, I guess if anything ever came up, we could present this in the light most favorable. Medicare? Doctor, do anything wrong? He's entitled to do that. We can show that pimples are tumors. And so you give that advice. Go right ahead. It's okay. You could always change if they start coming after you. And so a year later, whether through a fired employee or just from review of records, that how come one guy removed 1,000 tumors last year? They come around and they say, what are you doing? And the doctor says, well, let's see some of these charts. And it becomes evident that this kind of upcoding, it's known as upcoding. And you say, all right, this is false claims. You're billing altogether wrong, and we have a feeling you knew what you were doing. Might there be a reason that your client would tell the Inspector General that, but I got legal advice on this. My attorney told me this, okay. Might want to prove that some conservative acted reasonably. But even if it weren't that impetus to do it, still the client might want to do it because there is a great variation in prosecution. Oh, there's 1,000. At $5,000, an incident and penalties. We think you owe us about $6 million. But you know what? If you cooperate, maybe we'll go away for a few hundred dollars, a few thousand dollars. If you don't cooperate, we'll be very hard on you. There's great discretion in the prosecution of these claims. And very often the initial claim comes in well over $1 million, or initial threat well over $1 million, sometimes $10 million. Very often they settle for the hundreds of thousands or even less. But you have to show you cooperate. You can show that you cooperate, you can show that you had a compliance plan in place or whatever. But they ask, well, what did your attorney say? What you don't want to say is, oh, well, that's attorney-client privilege. I'm not going to tell you that. Maybe the client wouldn't want to say because you may have told the client, it's not really right, but we might be able to defend it, but go ahead and do it, or, you do it at your own risk, but rather than saying just don't do it and stop. And so the Inspector General says, you mean
You're not going to tell us what your attorney told you? Well, that's not cooperating. It's the client's privilege to give up the attorney-client privilege. The attorney has no right to maintain it. It's not the privilege for the attorney. And so the attorney sometimes brought in, and this has happened. And it's a problem. There was a whole conference of New York State Bar Association Health Law Section, and the conference goes, when your client's problems become your own. It was right on this, because it's a conspiracy. It's a government. They can have big sticks. They can do and say what they want. They say, you're a conspirator in fraud and abuse. You gave this advice. So the second thing, important thing to take home from this lecture, this particular lecture, not only be careful with and try to discover key TOM actions that act correctly. The other thing is, expect that your advice will be discoverable and that you are at personal risk if you tell anyone who is contracting with the government, not Medicare or Medicaid, but Bowen also, tell them they can go outside of what's normal. But be very, very careful. Probably put it in writing exactly what you said or didn't say. Tell your client, you may not be able to ask me that. Maybe we should go for a ruling on this. Let them give you a ruling ahead of time to see if they're going to allow it or not. Okay. Are referral fees for medical care actionable? Yes, we said they are. They're kickbacks. Is failure to collect coinsurance deductible from patients actionable? They said they were. I didn't give you any reading on antitrust, but if you want to look at it, just a few pages will give you everything. But there's three main antitrust, federal antitrust acts, Sherman Act, Clayton Act, Federal Trade Commission Act. It says you can't restrain trade. All are applicable to physicians and hospitals, and the penalties could be severe. Treble damages, and usually someone who's disadvantaged by this, like an insurance company, which will point it out to the government and make the government initiate an action on that. But insurance companies are generally exempt from that. That the McCarran-Ferguson Act is like the savings clause of ERISA. No, nothing in this law shall be construed to affect the insurance companies. So, the theory behind that is the insurance companies are so highly regulated by the state, and the state has an interest in setting the insurance rates, and so we'll let that be. Of course, it's the political power of the insurance companies that to get that deal. And this disparity can cause an unlevel playing field in negotiating managed care contracts. Doctors and hospitals are disadvantaged. They cannot talk to each other. They have to become large so that they're one entity. You know, if you and the doctor next door gets together and says, you know, we're not going to contract with that insurance company. They're just paying us too little. You don't, and I don't. That's restraint of trade. However, if you say to the doctor next door, hey, let's form a corporation, let's be one entity, and then the two of you can negotiate as one unit, but you're an entity. You're not colluding with any entity that is not you. And there is one exception in the antitrust to that. In various ways, If a group of physicians got together and accepted risk, accepted capitated contracts, they generally were not subject to antitrust. because they were a group acting in concert. It was almost as if they were one entity. They were accepting the risk together. They were a recognizable group. Okay, articles discussed. Why did employer groups claim that Healthy San Francisco program violated ERISA? The same story. You'll find that on at least two of the exams, because they were the claim was that it's interfering with an ERISA plan that is preempted by ERISA, because they were saying that San Francisco firms had to cover their employees or pay a fine. It's the RILA case all over here. We've also said that the Massachusetts law has elements of that, and that may be attacked on the basis of ERISA. What are the benefits of e-prescribing? Where all prescriptions have to be in electronic form? Safer. A lot of mistakes made. We haven't gotten into this year very much. It hasn't been prominent in the press. But even the AMA acknowledges that there are 100,000 deaths a year in hospitals or inpatients by unavoidable circumstances, by avoidable mishaps, avoidable circumstances. And one of them is mismedication. Wrong medicine, wrong dose, wrong patient. Doctor's poor handwriting is made. Jokes are made of it, but it is not funny when it comes to prescribing. So that's one of the benefits. E-prescribing cuts down on errors. Why is lack of catastrophic insurance a problem for the AARP-sponsored program? Must have been a problem. What did they do recently? We're not going to sponsor those programs anymore. Because I think that this is an issue that came up this year that we've never dealt with before. The idea that insurance companies were selling insurance policies that really weren't insurance policies. They were low-level reimbursement policies. So when you really needed the insurance, you really got sick and had the $100,000 illness, the policy was long exhausted. Even some of the Massachusetts policies, in order to get the cost down, have limited coverage way out further when you need it, but has the illusion of covering you because you do get some reimbursement before. So why is the AMA warning physicians about incentives for prescribing generic drugs? You know, that article would be a good article to show reading between the lines. I mean, we said the AMA is telling that if a physician accepts an incentive from their managed care company to prescribe generic drugs, and Medicare and Medicaid patients are involved, that's a kickback. And that's wrong. That's wrong advice. Because the arrangements between the managed care company and the physician are, on the basis of that, on the basis of incentives, are not subject to fraud and abuse. It's not the physician. It's not a referral or a kickback from someone who's getting the referral from that doctor. You know, the doctor is not referring the patient to the managed care company who's giving the doctor a kickback. It's a contractual arrangement between the two, and the tendency for that arrangement is for Medicare to be billed at lower price. And so here the AMA is trying to scare doctors that don't accept incentive payments for prescribing generic medicines.
You know, as cynical as I am, I was amazed by that, by the brashness of that article. What? Read between the lines. Who is the AMA aligned with nowadays? Who puts all the ads in JAMA? Right. Who supports medical education at the and supports the annual convention of the AMA? Right. Somebody say it. It's pharmaceutical companies, and it's not the generic companies that are providing these huge amounts of money for JAMA and the specialty journals, you know, putting in two-page ads and whatever. But this one, reading between the lines, you cannot help but conclude that the AMA is acting as a mouthpiece for the drug companies. And by now you should know that what that advice that they gave is just not true. It was blatant. Okay. How might the healthcare industry prove to be a mitigating factor in the present economic downturn? 16% of the economy may become more as the denominator decreases, as the denominator decreased by 0.5% recently. But it's pretty much a constant, and it's funded in ways that are also a constant. So it may be a mitigating factor. How can we evaluate medical sensitivity as applied to the use of Crestor, to the use of medical imaging tests? I've given you a number of examples which require an evaluation of medical necessity. Do you remember? One is Crestor, one is medical imaging. Do you remember the other two that I gave you? One was the papillomavirus vaccine, right? And I know there was a fourth. Knee surgery. I gave you how knee surgery seemed no better than medical treatment. So why is it necessary? So the ability to argue medical necessity, should be paid for, shouldn't be paid for, is probably a basic tool of this course. They understand medical necessity and argue with the two tools that we discussed in the last 2 weeks, one, duty to prevent, learn and have formula, and the other is quality, QALY. How many quality life years can be achieved by this expensive treatment, or not expensive treatment, whatever, with 50,000 being sort of an agreed upon for the price that society should pay for one quality, one year of 100% quality life. Why are the actions of some colleges regarding student health insurance coming under scrutiny? This hits really home. It was the last article I gave you last week. And notice I didn't give you any. I had to control myself. I really did. There were some good ones. But. Why? What's the issue? It was the same issue as the loan issue the colleges acted badly on. Some very big, wealthy colleges like Columbia. Remember in the loan issue, they were getting kickbacks for recommending loan sources for student loans. It's the same thing here, only it's even more restrictive. You know, we have a student health policy, and we get it from Big Care, and you must take it. Everyone who comes in must take it. There are some colleges that say you can't be on campus without this insurance. You don't want to have to pay for it because you get sick. And so this article says, you know, there's some kickbacks involved in this, the choice of the company. And maybe students shouldn't be required. Or at least perhaps show that they have better coverage elsewhere, which many students do also for their parents. Okay, test taking. I'm going to go over the exam. It's no different taking this exam.
Really?
No different
from taking the bar.
So any skills that you can get, any process that you can enter into, habits that you can form, taking this or most any other essay exam, will serve you well for the bar. The only exception is, you know, I let you bring in your materials. But the truth is, you can only look at the materials. You know, in a practical sense, you can only look at the materials to maybe get a case name or maybe refresh your memory about a little point, because you don't have time to research it during the exam. So you can glance at your notes to see where's the big point that you missed, or you know that we discussed the case and you have a little time, so you'll write the name of the case in. But in some ways, open book exams are harder than closed book exams. You have to know the book better in some ways, because you know, standards are higher, I suppose. Open book exams for accuracy of case names or case details. But with that, other than that exception, it's always the same, you know. And the earlier you learn to organize the answers along a particular pathway, I think the easier time you'll have with the bar. And you have to know that opinions, judicial opinions, are written the same way. You know, a good judicial opinion is a good answer to a bar exam. And you may have heard this a number of times, but the answer should be issue-oriented, and issue spotting is probably the most important part of how you organize, for example. And although there's a temptation to start writing right away and get a head start on this, the time that you spend thinking about the answer before you write is golden time. And at least you should issue spot and write down the issues. They do issue, the rule, sometimes rule proof, application of the rule to the issue, and the least important is the conclusion, how this should turn out, although you should come to a conclusion. Also good to say probably, not will, turn out this way. The other set of skills, the set of skills not only spotting the issue, but grouping the issues so that the paper doesn't become cumbersome, of organizing the paper correctly or the answer correctly. And a good rule to follow is look at the call of the question and see if in that call of the question there is a suggestion of how to organize the paper. Okay? So let's start with the December 2007 exam. And the first thing that you should do on question number one is look at the qual of the question. Some people do that. They don't even look at the question first. They just look at the last. What are they asking me to do? Discuss the liability and defenses of I'm a nurse, the doctor, and Hofstra Hospital and Great Bay. Well, that's suggesting how to organize this answer. Why not? I mean, you probably should say, well, let's take each of those and discuss the issues of liability for each of them. By the way, when you read cases, you very rarely find say that says the issue in this case is, or we're going to discuss the issue of that. The rule is, and now we're going to apply it, right? And our conclusion is this, which in a court case is the holder. But it's there nevertheless. If you read the case, it's there. Every case. Sometimes now we come to the theory of answer whether Great Big is liable on respondeat superior. And then usually they give a number of cases of and statutes which are really saying, here's the rule, here's the law. A little bit of maybe the statute and then a little bit of proof from cases. The big word that you know that you are or a judge is doing application of the rule to the issue is a word that appears quite frequently, whether in cases, and you should use it also, I think, as a little four, it's a four-letter word called here, or in this case. You're going to apply the rule here. You're going to apply the rule to this case, to this issue. Okay. So, let's take one of these defendants or one of these actors and discuss the liability and defenses. So what happened was Great Big had sent I'm a nurse, right into the emergency room to instruct doctors on how the managed care company wanted the doctors to treat super ill. Super ill was a very expensive disease, and this managed care company is trying to get all super ill patients sent to a particular hospital. And so because that hospital, special hospital, could treat super ill at less cost. Managed care company would not have so much cost. The theory is the society being managed care company gets better deal. You should let the managed care company get that because it may be reflected next time around in lower premiums for everybody. In the short run, however, probably makes more profit for Great Big. So we can discuss I'm a nurse. I would rather take Hofstra Hospital first. It just seems easier as you get along. What are the liabilities? Hofstra Hospital.
Here's a page who came to the emergency room. Told to go away. Does that make you think of anything? The main exception to the duty not to treat? No duty to treat? There are many theories of why the law has evolved so that if a patient comes to emergency room, a patient should be treated. And the law is called, anyone? EMTALA, Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, and it has certain requirements for hospitals and physicians. So issue is, Hofstra Hospital liable under EMTALA? Okay? Then you don't have to say issue. Regarding Hofstra Hospital, is there liability under EMTALA? The next thing you would say is the rule. What's the rule? If a patient comes to the emergency room, EMTALA requires that the patient be screened in the way other patients are screened, that they be stabilized and transferred only, sent to other hospitals, transferred only for specific reasons, only when it's in the best interest of the patient. A doctor has to certify with specificity that reason. The receiving hospital has to be notified and accept the patient. Receiving hospitals, well, set aside, cannot deny unreasonably a transfer. Records have to be sent. Patient has to be advised with specificity of the reason for the transfer. And the fine is, for a hospital, 50, hospital of any reasonable size, is $50,000. A tiny hospital, $25,000. But in this case, $50,000. Hospital is a large hospital. Per incident. Not per patient. Per incident. And so what are the liabilities under the Hofstra Hospital under EMTALA? $50,000 for not screening. $50,000 for transferring without reason. $50,000 for not having a certification. $50,000 maybe for not stabilizing. $50,000 for not contacting the receiving hospital. So, anything else? Any other issue for Hofstra Hospital? Sometimes you can read between the lines of these questions, and that normally a well-constructed question doesn't have even a word that is that cannot be used as extraneous. So here, the doctor, MD, an emergency room physician employed by the hospital. And here, the doctor also was instrumental in sending the patient away, is hospital liable for the doctor's actions? That could be the issue. Is hospital liable for the actions of the doctor, its employee? What's the rule? As an agency theory, a respondeat superior, the employer can be liable for the actions of the employee. Here, the doctor sent the patient away. As a result, the patient was injured. It's likely that hospital will be held liable for the doctor. Any other would the hospital be liable on its own for the injuries that the injuries to Mr. Worker? You know, is there corporate liability? Did the hospital not do something that it should? So is there, you know, the issue, does the hospital have corporate liability? The rule is that hospitals have a duty to provide, provide the environment for good medical care. They can't hire doctors who are not who are not licensed. They can't hire doctors who are they haven't screened properly. In this case, although there's no indication that they did anything wrong in hiring doctors, certainly they should have had, could have had procedures in place so that an outside RN from a managed care company couldn't have that much control of an emergency room. You could make that case. And corporate liability. How about the doctor himself? Was there a doctor-patient relationship? Doctor never agreed to see that patient. Doctor essentially told the patient, I'm not going to see you. Go elsewhere. So what's the rule? Doctor-patient relationship is initiated by contract. Sometimes that contract between the doctor and the patient is because the patient is a what? Intended beneficiary of a third party contract. Here, patient came to the hospital. Society has said if you put up an emergency room sign, you've already begun to treat. You have an obligation because set up a situation where the patient is relying on an emergency room sign rather than going someplace else. So society has assigned to hospitals a certain status. So there was a contract between the hospital and the patient who came to the emergency room, as evidenced by even a number of laws before EMTALA. But you could say it's evidenced by EMTALA that society imposed the contract, but not to the doctor. But here, the doctor is an employee of the hospital. Employed the doctor for the purpose of taking care of such patients. That's a third-party beneficiary intended. So yes, doctor-patient relationships did exist, and did the doctor have an EMTALA violation? Yeah. Separate penalties for doctors as well. The rule is that doctors have obligation under EMTALA. The doctor had to certify, didn't certify. How about Great Big? Liability, are they rendering care? Is Great Big rendering care? The issue is Great Big rendering the care. They have malpractice liability for actually hands-on care. The rule is that advice can be medical care. Here, an employee gave medical advice, told the patient to go elsewhere. Have a similar case, very similar case. Herdrich case, where there was actually a doctor in the emergency room there, mostly to protect the interests of the insurance company, employed by the insurance company. So you could remember that case, you could give that case, say, prove the rule that the insurance company was held liable for the actions of, that this was actually rendering care. And was this just a coverage decision? Could Great Big have the defense that it was just a coverage decision, they weren't rendering care, and then you could go through a Firestone type of analysis that coverage decisions. I think I even must have said yes. Mr. Worker, because the name implies that he's working. But if I didn't say it, you would say, you would have to say in this case, if. And normally you don't do ifs. Normally you don't do ifs, unless it's a very narrow issue. And here it's an important narrow issue. If Mr. Worker received his medical care through an employer plan, and you could talk about deference being given to Great Big for coverage decisions, no matter what circumstance. So I implied it, but that he was a worker, but I didn't say it. So that would be a situation where you might say if. But be careful by saying if you don't really have to, because you take it outside to a whole other set of circumstances. How about I'm a nurse. Did she have a doctor-patient relationship? You could make that point. So I'm a nurse, have a doctor-patient relationship. Liable for her actions as renderer of care, in the same way that Great Big could be liable for her actions. And you see, you can't get all of this. Right? There's more than you could really ever get. No one gets everything, but that's the way I say you should organize it and go off. Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll do number two, and then I'll do my quick summary, and we'll call it a semester. So take a quick break and we'll come back in 10 minutes.
Yes, Mr. Quinn.
What about that one sentence?
It's the hardest thing to limit the conclusion to what is actually in the body of the paper. It's the hardest thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
How are you?
Okay, I looked over the paper.
Thank you.
Not really careful. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I looked over the paper. I had to look at it. Oh,
yeah, yeah. No, okay. I just want to make sure you got it.
It printed out.
Oh, thank you.
I
never know how it's
going to
print.
I actually sent it in Word again, because I transferred it to Word and it was awful.
I don't know what to do with that.
I right-clicked on the attachment.
Okay.
And one of the choices was print. So I printed it that way. It came out fine. What is that program?
I don't even remember. It's one of the... it's a Word program, but it's like a more... It's a very new one. It's like a 2007 Office something. I can't even open things on half my other computers.
Right.
So I can only do it at home. And I have a laptop that I can do it on. But in my office, I don't have the same program. So I can't even download my own stuff to myself. So... But thank you.
Yeah, so I did get it, and I printed it today. So.
Okay, thank you.
The antitrust stuff we didn't get to, is it going to be on the
exam? No more than what I told you.
Okay.
And I think if you look over other exams, it's not a bad one.
Okay.
It's like a separate course almost.
Yeah.
You just have to know it exists.
Okay.
When were you planning on sending out those the other tests?
I have them. I have them ready to go.
Okay.
So maybe I'll send them out tonight. I should send them out tonight because I'm not going to.
We've got a while to test them until
7:00.
So get a little bit of time until.
Yeah. So you'll notice that one of the test is from 2 years ago, and it has all Katrina stuff in it.
Yeah.
Society just fell apart in this one situation. the 2005. I might mention in my email, it's really, it was in response to Katrina and all the hospitals that were emergency rooms or couldn't get to them. Nurses couldn't leave the hospital. The question is, when could you abandon a patient in a situation like that?
A lot of the nursing homes, people were abandoned.
Yeah, and some hospitals, there were some charges that nurses had actually given before they were about to abandon the patient, had given them medicine to kill them so they wouldn't suffer. Couldn't get them out. It was an issue of the doctor-patient relationship with nurses and doctors. When can you abandon a patient? It hardly ever comes up, but it did come up again and again during Katrina. The answer is you could abandon the patient if there's no hope of saving the patient. And you're about to lose your own life. Other than that, I mean, if those two things don't correspond, then you gotta stay.
So they weren't charged with. Were any of the nurses charged with liability?
For abandonment?
Yeah.
No, the ones that were charged with murder. And
it would have been better if they let them suffer.
Well, as it turned out, they really didn't. They really didn't do what they were thought to have done.
Yeah.
Patients had died of heat exhaustion, and what they gave was. Eventually, the charges were dismissed, but it went on for 2 years, ruined their life. And really, the bad actors weren't in New Orleans at all. The bad actors were sitting someplace else, not doing what they should have been doing. Like the
National Guard commander that told the helicopter pilots, do not pick up any patients from the rooftops. You're not authorized to do that. That was really the first time that I can remember where it came, the realization that America was not organized to help each other. Right. That the poor were going to be left behind. It fell upon individual citizens to traipse down there and do it. Some corporations, like I think it was Health South, did send evacuation teams to get the patients out of their hospitals if they had room to get the patients out of the public hospitals, and they did get some patients out of the public hospitals, and then they charged them for favoring their own patients. It's a tough thing. It was an amazing time medically. We had one. I gave you one article this time about it. That when the hurricane was approaching New Orleans this year, all the nursing homes evacuated their patients, and it turned out not to be necessary, but overly cautious, and I don't know if it was in that article, but it was thought that one patient didn't get ran out of oxygen in the process and died. You know, so that moving the patients were in that predicament.
Well, sometimes, yeah, kind of more detrimental than the ones who get in very critical conditions.
Right. I don't think if 2 years before there hadn't been a disaster, then any of those patients. I think the nursing home operators had reason to believe that if they left the patients there and the patients were in danger, that they could count on from a number of sources of getting them out, you know?
Because they individually couldn't.
Right. Yeah. I think they could have said, well, the National Guard will come. Yeah. Right? Well, the police will come, we'll get them out.
That's what you would expect. Right.
The Army.
Yeah. Huh?
Even the Canadian Army might be helped, right? The Mexican Army might be helped. Certainly they'll be helped. You don't have to move them in anticipation, right? So we made mistakes this year on the basis of saying that we can't count on anyone coming to rescue. That's tough. People have short memories, though, because it wasn't an issue in this election. You know, it didn't come up a lot. The failure of Katrina, right? Yeah, 2 years is a long time politically. People just forget. But where did that happen? Was that really New Orleans? People died, really?
We're still living in FEMA trailers.
Exposed to chemicals. Yeah.
Let's say that there, like I'm a clinical practice medicine doctor, let's say that there was a hospital, for instance, that was found by the courts to be practicing medicine. Because that's, what then is the liability? What can they?
Well, it usually comes in cases like this where the doctors say, you know, you can't do that to me because I'm the one practicing medicine, and now if you make that claim against me, it's only because you're practicing like this, of course. You can't restrict my practice of medicine because only agreements with other physicians would that be reasonable. Since you can't practice medicine, why are you restricting me to 50%?
Okay. that exists. It seems like it's a strange.
Yeah, especially the jobs. Each of us are not allowed to.
Yeah, I was reading some.
Unless they're running a hospital, I have a hospital license.
Yeah.
The insurance companies can't practice medicine. It's the theory of corporate practice medicine. They get to hide behind that, say, "Oh, our nurse advisors are not practicing medicine. We can't. We don't have a license." Okay. Second question. What's the call of the question? You are counsel to Assemblyman Smart. Explain in detail why this legislation might be preempted under the Constitution of the United States, and explain how the legislation might be worded to avoid such a challenge and yet advance Assemblyman Smart's goal. So, just think how a year has changed how I would write a question. Now that the tulip business is booming, the economy is going strong, and businesses are making record profits, and those son of a guns, they still won't, they're still trying to cut down on health care. But nevertheless, are holding employees responsible for a greater and greater share of the cost of care. Assemblyman Smart wants to introduce legislation that would prevent employers from offering plans that require employees to pay more than 40% of the cost of care provided by the employer. But the legislation would not require any employer to provide health care coverage of any sort. Just if you do, then you have to do it this way. So, what are you going to tell Assemblyman Smart? Assemblyman Smart, there are issues here, right? You're going to tell them the issues. Issue number one. Tell me, somebody. Yeah. Yeah. The issue is under the Constitution of the United States, is this state law going to be preempted? And what is the rule? The rule is that ERISA will preempt state laws. And rule proof, retail, in the Walmart case, RILA case, the state law was preempted. And you have a few other instances that I gave you that you could use. So, however, states, there's a savings clause. The issue is, if you aim this at insurance companies and not employers, can you get away with it? But you could go through the Deamer clause and say, if it's a self-employed plan, no employee benefit trust should be deemed to be an insurance company, but so if conclusion is, if we aim it at insurance companies alone, then we say insurance company, as an insurance company, you cannot write an insurance policy with this more than a 40% contribution from anyone. You have to extend it to anyone. Right. Is there an issue? Can this just be for employee-sponsored plans? You could do a Kentucky Miller, there's Kentucky analysis. No, to avoid preemption, you have to aim it at insurance companies. It has to be a two-prong test. It's a law that usually applies to insurance companies, and it has to alter the
risk relationship between the insurance company and the subscriber. Right? And so the conclusion is, in the end, that Aman insurance companies don't mention employers, and the issue is how many of the residents of Hofstra will be benefited by that. And, you know, go through an analysis that only self-insured plans would not be affected by it. If an insurance company were involved at all, then it would not be preempted. The law itself would not be preempted. Don't make the mistake in this case of saying I'm going through a Collad Davila analysis, saying that liability under the plan will be preempted. The tort liability will be preempted, because that's not what this is about. This is about a plan to compel coverage, not a plan about liability as of a managed care company's immunity to prosecution under state tort law. That's a different issue. This is compelling coverage. That's the other issue. And then there's also others. You know, the Senator is smart. We could achieve this if we can get some legislation passed, federal legislation passed, then federal legislation wouldn't be preempted by the Constitution. It is the Constitution. And so we maybe should aim at that rather than try the state law. Okay. Any questions about organizing and IRACing? Have you done it? People try, but you know, it seems like in a lot of exams, they start out okay with IRAC, and then you either get pressed for time or get tired, and then just go to kind of a free form, and not go do that analysis that you should do. So, but try. Okay. Everything that I taught you in the next 20 minutes. Doctor-patient relationship, more complex, more parties involved nowadays than in 1960, greater patient involvement. Standard of care now is reasonable under the circumstances, no more locality rule. Informed consent has become what a patient reasonably would want to know under the circumstances. What a doctor should reasonably know that the patient would reasonably want to know under the circumstances. Big change from 1960 to 2005 is the involvement of government in medical care, especially as a payer. And although government always had a role of regulator and a police role, maintain that the government is getting its role as a regulator confused with its role as a payer. It sometimes uses its role as a regulator to protect its role as a payer, mainly fraud abuse. Managed care companies do not have that big stick. Managed care companies cannot throw anyone in jail for overbilling. So medical care, we said, is different than other endeavors or wishes, or activities, human activities. One of the things that we discovered were different is that the advisable level
of medical care is very close to the optimum level. That too much care can be as bad as too little. And there's very little difference between what's optimum care and what is reasonable care. Premium care doesn't get you much more, and too much premium care can be detrimental. And so you can determine, it's possible for someone on the outside to determine what is adequate or necessary. But we also say that no one really wants medical care, like repairing a car. You don't want to do it. It's expensive, intermittent, sporadic, and therefore ripe for insurance, third-party payers, and all the problems that go along with that. The notion that a dollar spent on medical care is bad, a dollar spent on anything else is good, seems to apply to medicine and nothing else. It probably is not true. That a dollar spent on medical care may be better for our economy than a dollar spent to buy that gooey stuff. Effective technology increases the cost of medical care, decreases the cost of almost anything else. That medical care has an overlay of charity to it, overlay of paternalism. And I offered you the notion that the doctor-patient relationship is not one of trust, it's one of profound distrust, that doctors have to work very hard to gain the trust of their patients. After all, everyone knows that a doctor has the power to heal you, a doctor may choose not to heal you, a doctor has the power to kill you, hurt you. Doctor-patient relationship begins with a contract. And very often, as we pointed out before, it's as that the patient is the intended third-party beneficiary of a contract that the doctor has with somebody else, like a hospital. There's no duty to treat in and of itself, no duty to which is no duty to rescue. But once treatment has begun, then it's no longer described as contractual. You're better off describing it as fiduciary, as trust. But the initiation of it is contractual. There's some exceptions to the notion that doctor-patient relationship doesn't exist, except through contract. EMTALA is the main exception. Also, discrimination laws, you can refuse a patient, but not for the wrong reasons. Also, ADA disability laws, and in some cases, child abuse laws and elder nursing home laws that doctor doesn't act to be charged with child abuse or elder abuse. If a relationship is established, there's a proper way to retreat from it. Otherwise, there can be a charge of abandonment. The proper way is to give adequate notice, always in writing, and to make sure that the patient has a way of getting care elsewhere. We went through the EMTALA duties before screening. The issue of coming to the emergency room. Someone comes to the emergency room, they don't have to walk inside. It can be on the outside. Matter of fact, they can be 500 feet away. In doctor-patient relationship, there are more instances of more ways that a doctor can receive criminal charges other than practicing medicine without a license or patient abuse. But now there's criminal charges associated with privacy, HIPAA,
fraud and abuse, elder abuse, child abuse. There's a duty of record keeping to prevent charges of fraud, abuse, of overbilling, and for malpractice defense and for criminal defense. There's a duty of record keeping. There's a role of the erudite intermediary that pharmaceutical companies can do direct to patient advertising, but really always falls on the doctor to be the one to make the last decision, to be the learned intermediary when using a product that someone else provides. Who is a doctor? Find someone who can diagnose and treat independently without supervision and bill for it independently. And MDs, DOs, doctors, podiatric medicine, optometrists, PhD, psychologists, MSWs doing psychotherapy, nurse practitioners and midwives can all be considered to be at least in the role of doctors. And the new question mark is health coach. Who is a health coach? And what is a health coach providing? Even patient advocates to some extent. What is managed care? Well, different between managing care and managed care. Managing care, Medicare and Medicaid manage care. They have the same processes in place. But managed care has to be private, has to be a company involved. A company who, for a preset fee, we call it premium, agrees to provide a defined set of benefits, health benefits, to the subscriber. But the real difference is that those benefits are provided through contractual arrangements with those who actually render the care. It's not an indemnity policy where the company says, just go to whomever you want and we'll reimburse you. That's the big difference. It's the relationship between the render of care and the managed care organization that is the hallmark of managed care. There's been an evolution of managed care. At first, there was great deference given to managed care, great necessity to reduce the price of medical care. But there's been erosion, a great erosion in that deference given to managed care. And managed care, you could say, is now in decline. Almost no pure managed care contract exists where the patient cannot go under any circumstances to see a doctor who does not have a contract with the managed care company. Almost all contracts are written with a point of service or a PPO template that says, yes, we will pay you something or pay out-of-network doctors something, not as much as we would have paid a doctor under contract, but we'll pay you something. An HMO liability for decisions are increasingly assigned to managed care companies, and we gave you all the theories about it: apparent authority, implied authority, respondeat superior for the actual renderer of care, for the HMO's liability for the actions of the actual renderer of care. Breach of contract, breach of warranty, corporate liability for not doing what a managed care company should do in providing a reasonable milieu for the provision of medical care.
And something that we didn't discuss is that there have been RICO claims against managed care companies. And I guess the reason we didn't discuss it didn't come up in any of the articles, since all the huge RICO actions are all dismissed eventually. All dismissed. I was part of the groups that had RICO actions against a number of insurance companies. They really, a number of them settled. They changed their ways. Each physician who was part of that got a few $100 back under the settlements. But the companies that didn't settle were eventually went without any penalties. The notion was that this was a these were a bunch of gangsters who colluded with plan to oppress the patients and it was an organized, concerted effort to cheat. And there were good arguments made, but in the end, RICO law was not applied. We went through the scenario about managed care going from a Kaiser Permanente situation, where the managed care organization had hospitals and physicians who were employed. They did everything. Ichabod with Waltz. It morphed from that to where most managed care organizations have no facilities to provide medical care. They just are the payer and have contracts with others to do everything. We said that Medicare Advantage is Medicare managed care is actually costing the government about 14% more than it would without managed care. And that's a big issue now, because it looks as if one of the first things that the Obama administration is going to do is just say, no more of that. Right? We need the money for other stuff. We went over the notion that fee-for-service induces overutilization. Capitation induces underutilization. Would be nice to have a mix of the two, so that that incentives are neutralized. So, you know, maybe it'll happen. We propose that concierge care has that element to it, with the patient paying a capitated fee, $1,000 a year, and the insurance companies paying the fee for service, and that if the fee for service were decreased to be more of a to not have a profit in it, and if all the profit came from the boutique fee, then that might neutralize the incentives, might make it right. We also had a toggle that said the liability of an HMO would depend on whether they were just a payer or render of care. The Kaiser Permanente with its own hospitals and employees is a render of care. They definitely have liability. An insurance company that has none of that is only a payer. But the question is, how much arranging for the services do you have to do before you're considered a renderer of care? Okay. Remember, ERISA has the savings clause that saves insurance companies, the DEMER clause that says employee benefit trusts are not insurance companies, that health benefits are looked upon as a gift, is there a trust, that generally the administrator of an employee benefit trust has the ability, if so given under the plan, to construe indefinite terms in the plan.
And the most important and definite term is medical necessity, meaning what needs to be covered under medical necessary, if the contract says that they'll cover all medically necessary care. Kentucky Associated Health Plans versus Miller, 2003 case, federal case. Two requirements for a law to avoid preemption under ERISA. Law must be specifically directed toward entities engaged in insurance and must substantially affect the risk pooling arrangement between the insurer and the insured. Okay. We've gone over today fraud and abuse. Well, that's all. I'll skip that for the time being. And go to the last part of this is that, you know, recent ongoing developments, recent trends, ongoing developments, patient empowerment, patient-directed care. If the patient pays for it, are they more empowered, less empowered? That's consumer-directed health care. That's an issue that will be continually debated. Pay for performance, paying not just for doing something, but for doing it well. Information technology and state's initiative toward universal health care coverage. I think the mental health parity law hasn't really reached the press yet. And it's there. It's been passed with the bailout program. What that's going to mean, I think you could pay attention. I also want you to remember the number of 300 million, which is the population of the United States. It's very good when you, even with the bailout, we're going to give AIG $68 billion. Well, how much is that per person? I already went over the medical necessity cases that I gave you. Papillomavirus case, the overuse of imaging, CT cases, the knee surgery case, and the Crestor case. You really should be able to argue both sides of that. There is an evolving physician shortage, and it will change the doctor-patient relationship, I believe. These inadequate insurance policies that we discussed today is certainly a new issue that we've discussed this year, not before. The effect of healthcare on the economy, the notions about that are changing every day. I really haven't heard in the past month that it was healthcare that's making GM be on the brink of disaster. Okay. And you should look, be aware when the decision, Supreme Court decision, Wyeth v. Levine comes down. If it's decided on Wyeth's case, it will change things. It will change things. It's decided on in favor of Levine. Then what's happening at present will not change. I want to say one more thing, that being the seminar class, a small class of that gotten to know you, you should feel free to ask me for references. I'm yours forever, you know, wherever. Years later, you can feel free to ask questions, and hopefully, I'll be around.
On that note, if you have questions while we're studying, can we email you?
Yep. Okay. I'll be here. You can call me. Did I give you my. Sometimes at a last minute panic, you might want to. Call me on my cell phone. I don't mind. Did I put it on? Somewhere around. My cell phone number is 516-241-0831. Okay. Good class. Well, it doesn't. And as a matter of fact, I think I gave you a mixed message about when it was due. I was actually surprised that I had written December 1st, because I meant to write the Tuesday that class would have been. So it's really, you know, the 2nd.
Okay.
All right? I left it Monday. It was already written down.
But I did say something along the way that it was going to be the time when the class would have been, which is actually the second.
Okay, so it's going to be the second.
Right. Yeah, just email it to me.
Right. Can't say that that's an okay quote.
because the first option you said you just you use it as a reference, not that you use it as framework.
Right.
And so you have to do something else other than that, which is either
quoted or reworded.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't want it to come off as that I had played right when I wrote the paper that I had plagiarized.
Yeah. That's what I'm supposed to do. So I have to do that.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's okay to use those words.
Well, I understand that. After we spoke today and it brought up yesterday and today, my concern was again with my I have an issue with hospital law as far as their writing teaching. In which case, then I said to myself, well, maybe I don't know this stuff. And when I was talking to you about it, and that's my problem. Like, you know, I've spoken to these and whatnot about my concern where, you know, writing in the legal field is a tremendous part of it. You know, more so than, and that's the problem. I mean, I have that issue with the school, but then when it came to write a paper, and you brought it up, I said, you know, then I don't want you to think that I'm plagiarizing. Yeah. Where
I just think you didn't know how to do it. You know, but that's my job.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
be a writing teacher as well.
Well, yeah, absolutely, exactly.
The other legal writing is what Greece.
Right, but there are certain aspects you should pick up through classes, and that's why I didn't know. I mean, I didn't want to come off as I plagiarized any part of the paper. Okay.
Yeah,
I had to clarify that.
It's not an issue. And you're going to make tremendous improvement, which gives me pleasure.
Yeah, you know, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much for your help.
To some extent, I get a kick out of that more than I would just reading a paper someone already had it all together. It's a great variation. Yeah. 10 out of 30 are not being able to write.
Right.
They bring in different levels of writing competence and knowledge.
Exactly.
Some people are better technicians at writing. Even if it's not technical writing, you're not trying to do
it. Right.
Everyone says I'm
not fair. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm
not a great writer, especially not a great writer.
Yeah.
or go to very great extents to make beautiful sets.
Yeah. No, and I learned a lot, but I just didn't want to come up as, you know, I had at any point plagiarized any of the materials.
And I'm not a footnote freak either, or even a technician. Probably that's one of the things you really learn that one.
Yeah, and that's.
And so I don't. You learn that elsewhere.
Right.
And the right kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I had a.
Yeah.
I think I had a good vast variety, because I mean, really just.
Yeah.
On that topic, just really working with the case law, the statute, and whatever I could find in certain cases out there. But that was.
I think that's a great paper. It's a useful paper.
Yeah.
Good thing.
How was
people will read that and add on that.
Yeah.
Even help, you know, like. Carpenter Wild and Travis might be interested in that paper, to read that paper, because they are unaware of that. They do a lot of advice on it. Email people. I met someone yesterday here, who's an adjunct here, who's a special assistant. He's become the counsel for the president of the
charge
of the secretary. Oh, okay. And he emailed me, and he said, maybe some students would be interested in the topic.
Maybe.
veteran insurance.
No, I've not another year.
Yeah, he wants someone to start the veteran this year more. So I'll
yeah. I mean, it's very positive. That's definitely great networking. But yeah, I mean, I just wanted to talk about the review. This is bothering me after.
All right. So remember, you're mine. You know, I'm responsible. But it, you know, I have to prevent you from doing anything that could be interpreted.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I love my background, but look at all the. Go back to size and section and whatnot, and space and all that. But I think, yeah, if you came up, I didn't want it to come off. All right.
Do you see how important it is for that to be a written first draft by teaching?
Yeah, oh, oh, absolutely.
The requirement is an outline. What am I going to do with an outline?
Yeah, I think it's, yeah. And to me, an outline early on is a good step, like, you know, by the end of a month before it's due, have your, you don't have a first draft, you're, I mean, you're really up to date, because it's not giving you the opportunity to, you know, and us get the feedback from, you know, what you want, but.
Yeah, it was good, you submitted more than
yeah. So I want to go through it again and figure out more grammar or whatnot.
Yeah. And also, see, some of the something, and also economy of words. If there's, you've got words that you could do without.
Right. Okay, that's right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's a little library. Do you know, I have a question. Do you know if this building is open on Friday? I know the library is closed.
The library's closed?
Yeah. Is the actual building open on Friday? Do we have access to if you wanted to come here?
Yeah. I don't know. The library is totally closed.
Yeah, everything.
And everything too?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little.
Right.
Yeah, I that's not a good. I mean, as a student, I don't find it to be a fair decision, but, you know, they make the rules. But I was just wondering if the actual building is closed. Because you could always come in here and move to one. I'm going to try. I guess the registrar's office?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, it might be like a family dime, so, like, my whole house, all six or seven of us back, I can't study there, because it's not conducive, so, that's why it's like, I come here, so my husband, you know, I was supposed to stay at like 1 o'clock, doing it, but as far as it's a huge, it's a whole day.
I've never been here on that Friday, even though I can always get into
the. Right, that's why I don't know if it was like, does our swipe cards work?
No, but, no, I had a key.
Oh, really? Right. Yeah, because, I mean, like you said, it's during finals times. Yeah. You close the exam, so we don't get many days between the end of classes and reading, and that's just. And I have that whole day is 2 days in a row. Yeah. They should have known that people aren't going home because I mean I live here, but people aren't going home because of the economy and then
also the flights.
That and you know you're now it's so late in the semester.
Yeah, Thanksgiving comes late, and the semester was a week early.
Exactly. Some people aren't right. Like a lot of my friends that live in Florida, they're not going home. Yeah, I mean, essentially you're paying to go study there. So, but that's why I was trying to figure out if we can get access in here on Friday. But I'll check with Gail. I guess.
I have to guess.
That's what I figured. Right.
So,
I feel bad for my friends who are first years. That's why I have a lot of sympathy because it's Frank's has a different story. You can have less time and whatnot, but when they have no clue what's going on or what to expect and not have reading time, that's a lot. That's not fair to me. I understand that, but
yeah, we're reading days.
Yeah, we had a Tuesday, Thursday, sometimes.
I used to kid, but I don't have to read.
Syracuse, we had the last day classes, finals for the next day. That's why I was like, we get used to it as students now, but
it's more important.
It's
spring.
Yeah.
The reading day should be
Down here, yeah. It's funny, because last year, when they closed the school early last year, we spent, I think it was like 8 inches now, the whole place shut down. I think it's a normal day in Syracuse. We don't close for anything.
All right.
I'll do it at the library.
Okay, well, good luck on your
hand. Thank you.
Well, you can always text.
Are you going to have access to your email this weekend? Or your
book? I got that Verizon trading
card.
That's like a little phone, so that you can't use it as a phone. I can even get my email on my car now. Turning your computer into a BlackBerry.
Yeah.
And it's good, except I have no idea what the bill is going to be at the end of the month.
A lot of the new computers come with that. They come in the top to get built into it. Like I did the new Dells.
Yeah.
The Verizon card is now built
into it.
Yeah. So you don't have to USB slot anymore.
So because where we have our lake house in the north part of New Jersey, the only way to get anything up there is dial up.
Right.
There's no DSL line that's reached us yet. And even the cable company. They haven't reached us. They're still a mile away from getting computer services.
Wow.
So this was the only way, but you know what? It worked.
Yeah.
And the other day, I told my wife, take out the computer. You can access road cameras from it.
Yeah.
Right? So we said, let's see what the George Washington Bridge looks like.
Yeah.
And she was able to do it right in the car. You know?
It's great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm sure I'll be emailing you questions. Have a good night.
You too.